Thanks for coming along tonight, folks, and where Andrew Lee makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think it's the third occasion you're here. I'll introduce him briefly. Of course, he's the member for Fenner, which it is now, but he was originally elected to the House of Representatives in 2010. He was a parliamentary secretary to the Prime Minister for a period in the previous government, and of course is now the Minister for Competition, the Assistant Minister for Competition, Charities and Treasury, and also the Assistant Minister for Employment. But beyond that, he was a Professor of Economics at the ANU, holds a PhD in Public Policy from Harvard, and is the author of several previous books. And it says on the blurb of this book, The Shortest History of Economics, which we're talking about tonight, he's a keen triathlete and a marathon runner, which, there you go. So Andrew, if you come up here. Thanks for doing this.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me along, and I acknowledge the Gadigal people in whose lands we're meeting tonight.
Now, it's a great book. I read it at the weekend, partly in the car with Anne driving down to Canberra and back. Anne kindly drove as I read, but I read it, and it's a great book, and it's a huge amount of work. We're trying to cover everything from well before BC up to pretty well yesterday, or last Sunday when you ran the marathon, okay? So, I'll start off with the book. You say, right at the end, you say, I said at the outset, the book aimed to do three things. Tell the story of how capitalism and the market system emerged, discuss the key issues and the people who shaped the discipline of economics, and outline how economic forces have affected world history. So we'll start with all of them, and I'll go through the book with you. But remember that early on in the book you say you're a congenital optimist. So we'll test you on that. Now, early on you say this small book tells a big story. It's the story of capitalism. Some of your colleagues in the labour movement didn't like capitalism much in the old days. So what's happening here? Now, you
The new breed of labour politicians I would describe as pro-growth progressives, Jared. We are people who understand that the market system is incredibly powerful for generating wealth, but that it doesn't necessarily generate a fair distribution of outcomes. And in that into that space, there's an important role for government. The welfare state is partly set up to deal with the vicissitudes of luck. Somebody falling ill when they don't have many savings. The luck of a bright kid being born to poor parents. The bad luck that happens when disaster strikes. And part of the shortest history of economics is telling the story as to how steadily over the course of the past couple of centuries, institutions have emerged that help people essentially manage risk. So one conception of government you can have is that government plays the role of risk manager. And I think many of, in my party, would look askance at the view that somehow government can do a better role in making the initial allocation decisions. You look at the difference in income between East and West Germany, the drop in income after the Russian Revolution, the rise in income after the private property reforms in China of 1978, all of that points to the power of capitalism for growing total living standards.
You do make a lot of the concept of luck in your book. I mean, it doesn't take many pages, but it comes out quite strongly, which sort of... economics is not supposed to be about luck, is it? It's supposed to be about something else. But tell us, because you make this point about Thomas Carlyle, who referred to economics of, you're an economist, as a dismal science, and presumably he would have regarded you as a dismal man, but tell us what you really think of him.
Well, Carlyle would have regarded all of us as a bit dismal because he was a racist who believed that slavery should be reintroduced. The dismal view to which he was referring was the dismal view that all people are equal, regardless of the colour of their skin. So I bear the badge of dismal science quite proudly, as do many of my colleagues.
Now, we'll just break away for a minute, because you've got these various breakout themes, and you talk in your book about religion, and you talk about religion in an economic sense. You talk about religion and its relation to competition, talking about the great religions of Judaism, Christianity and Islam. So what's religion and competition all about?
One of the striking things you notice, Jared, is that in the United States, which has a plethora of competition for religions, religiosity is higher than it is in some of the Scandinavian countries, which have a state church. And that accords with what many economists would believe about monopolies, which is that they tend to drive down total consumption by driving up prices. Competitive atmosphere was also what prevailed at the time of the emergence of the Abrahamic religions. And that competition between different religions increases the total religiosity in a society. Somewhat to the surprise of some of those who believe that the monopolies would increase take-up of religion, the reverse seems to be true.
And I think you also make the point that in areas where religions compete, religion is stronger.
That's right. And it's a healthy thing for religiosity as a whole to have that competition, just as it's healthy for the economy as a whole to have competition. Each individual business wants to be a monopolist. Much as the Sydney Institute might want to be the only think tank in town. In fact, the Sydney Institute benefits from the competition of ideas and from other think tanks in the market. And the same is true whether you're talking about banking or baby food or even beer.
Now, you talk about, you sort of start off looking at the agricultural revolution. Then you go on to the Industrial Revolution, and here you pick up the World Wars and the Great Depression coming at the end of that. So how did the Agricultural Revolution start, and what did it lead to?
The Agricultural Revolution kicks off somewhere between 10,000 and 8,000 BCE. It emerges in the Fertile Crescent, a region where regular flooding improved the quality of the soils, and where a number of different crops, known as the eight founder crops, turned out to be quite easily domesticable. Not every crop is easily planted, but that region had the good quality soils and good quality crops, which made it amenable to farming. But as farming emerges, you also see the way in which it shapes norms. So in certain parts of the world, plough-based agriculture emerged, and in other parts people farmed largely with digging sticks. The thing about the plough is it requires quite a bit of upper body strength, and so it tended to favour the men in that society and lead to greater gender role segregation. What's surprising is that now, thousands of years on, you can still see that difference between countries where plough-based agriculture prevailed and countries where digging stick agriculture prevailed. There's more sexism, there's more traditional gender roles in places where the plough first emerged.
And you also maintain that the plague, the Great Plague, the Black Death, killed feudalism. So how did that happen?
Well, the Black Death wipes out somewhere around a third of the population of Europe, and as a result, changes the balance between capital and labour. Before the Black Death, labour was fairly plentiful, and therefore it was easy to maintain feudalism and the control it embodied. After the Black Death, workers become more scarce. That labour scarcity drives up wages, and it allows workers in some cases to break free of their feudal shackles. Not that feudalism would have lasted for much longer without it, but the Black Death, if you like, put the final nails in the coffin of feudalism as it changed relative prices through Europe.
So before we get on to the Industrial Revolution, you talk about the Protestant Reformation, and you say some unkind things about the Catholic Church, because you make the point that the Lutherans in Germany, having different belief systems, I think worked a lot harder than, say, the Irish in Ireland. So what is it that drove the success of the Protestant nations of Northern Europe as distinct from the primarily Catholic nations of Southern Europe after the Reformation?
Well, some of the best work on this, Jared, is done by German scholars such as Ludger Wussmann, who has looked at variation within Germany or Prussia as it then was, and seen that in places which first saw the Protestant Reformation, you saw a significant increase in Bible reading, and that then drove literacy, which of course was an incredibly productive skill at a time when more and more books are being printed. So Protestants benefited from being part of a religion that encouraged them to read, and therefore effectively taught them a highly productive skill at a time in world history where being able to read and write really matters.
That's because the Lutherans and the Calvinists were invited to essentially have their own interpretation of the Bible, whereas the Catholics, the interpretation of the Bible was sort of handed down from, not on high, but from the Pope and those below him.
That's right. And Ludger Wussmann is sort of sceptical of theories of this which are focused around values and have the idea that Protestantism somehow encouraged people to work harder than Catholicism. He falls back on a more standard economic explanation, which is just that Protestantism bestowed on its adherents a really important skill. It's as though you set up a new religion which had at its heart that you had to learn advanced mathematics. You might not be surprised to discover that those who were part of that religion went on to earn more in the labour market because they had more of a skill that really mattered in the economy.
I think there was a theory that Max Weber, the German sociologist of the 20th century, had.
That's right. And so Wussmann's paper is titled, Was Weber Right? And it concludes, yes, Weber was right, but not for the reasons that he thought.
Now let's, I mean, your book darts around a bit, which is good. Let's talk a bit about the slave trade, because I was surprised to read that the worst slavers, or the nation's most into slavery, were the Portuguese, the Spanish, the French and the Dutch. So the Brits aren't in there. What was so significant in Portuguese running slavery?
Well, the Brits are early in the earlier abolitionists than some of the other countries, although historians recently have been pointing out that there's a significant role of British financiers in financing the movement of slaves in vessels run by other countries. Particularly Spain and Portugal, holding a number of those key Latin American colonies, really drove a large portion of the slave trade. They had colonies where agriculture was particularly human intensive, and so if you're looking at cotton or sugar, for example, their crops were having a large labour force is particularly useful. And in the colonies such as Cuba or Brazil, slaves are ubiquitous, and the huge volume of slaves that are of enslaved people who were trafficked across the Atlantic in that period by those countries really transforms those economies.
So towards the end of the book, you express concern about climate change, what the United Nations calls global boiling. But what about the colder period, where you make the point that the witches and witchcraft got badly treated in the days of global freezing?
Well, this is a lovely finding by Emily Oster, which illustrates the way in which people look to blame others for their misfortune. Emily Oster gets a series of historical accounts of witch burning through Europe and correlates that with the climate data. And she finds that the Little Ice Age coincided with a significant upturn in witch burning. Effectively, you can think of these as societies where things are going wrong, crops are failing, people are hungry, and they're looking for scapegoats. And they're finding them in single older women in their communities. Through superstition, they end up blaming those women who might have lived had the climate been more amenable during that period. And it's a reminder of the way in which humans can often look for an outside force to blame. I was thinking, as we're watching the scenes of the solar eclipse coming across the United States yesterday, how much past solar eclipses must have led people to think that something was going deeply wrong with the world and someone needed to be blamed for it.
So you move into the Industrial Revolutions, and Industrial Revolution, you talk about that leading to an urban revolution, but you also make points about wars, and essentially the First World War, the Second World War, the Napoleonic Wars, the American Civil War. You make the point that those nations or parts of nations that were wealthier tended to win because they could do more weapons. So just explain that a bit about the impact of the economy on wars, or the impact of wars on the economy.
Yeah, I mean, the striking thing about both the US Civil War and World War II is the huge imbalance of resources between the two sides at the outset of the war. Both the North in the US Civil War and the Allies in World War II had vastly more people, vastly larger economy, vastly stronger manufacturing sector and armaments sector. And yet their adversaries, the South of the United States and the Nazis, were far better tacticians on the battlefield. So these wars, which in principle should have ended in half the time that they did, ended up being longer because the side which had more material resources was far less effective at deploying those resources. Hitler's generals win, you know, all of those early battles through far better tactics. Lincoln is bemoaning in the White House the fact that he can't find himself a general who will take the fight up to the South. But ultimately, economics prevails, and the side that begins with more material resources is the side that's victorious in the end.
Talk us a bit about some of the economists. I was a bit disappointed. You named a Frenchman as the most influential economist, Frédéric Bastiat, which is nothing I wanted to read. But also you talk about Alfred Marshall, a Brit. So, and then I'll come to a couple of others that probably some of us here are more familiar with. So tell us about those two.
Well, Bastiat is a remarkable Frenchman who is involved in a whole range of different schemes, finds himself on the run from the authorities at times, and is somebody who's important in the establishment of the French monetary system. Alfred Marshall, much more of an establishment figure. He is responsible for the Marshallian Cross, the first proper depiction of supply and demand diagrams that you see depicted in every first year economics class. And you know, it's sort of striking, Jared, that Marshall is only coming along at the turn of the 20th century, laying out the principles of supply and demand. You know, the ancient Egyptians knew trigonometry when they were building the pyramids, and yet it takes until just a little over a century ago before some of these key economic principles are laid down.
Now, you also mentioned Joan Robinson, the British woman who was a bit of a favourite of the left in Australia, Colin Clark, who was a conservative, I guess, in Australia. He came to live in Australia, and Sadie Alexander, who you talk about. But Joan Robinson you speak of quite well in relation to her economic work, but you're very critical of Mao's China, and before she died she was an unequivocal supporter of Mao Zedong in China and of the dictatorship in North Korea. So tell us a bit about her, tell us a bit about Colin Clark, who I think came from Cambridge, ended up in Queensland, I think, and got relatives here, sons and grandsons, and Sadie Alexander.
So Joan Robinson was indeed a complex woman, and she was incredibly bold in challenging Alfred Marshall, who was a firm believer that women did not have an important role to play within the Cambridge Economics Department. She challenged him not only through her gender but also through her work, and arguing that markets operated less perfectly than Marshall would have you believe. She also coined the term monopsony, which is highly relevant in the time when we're thinking about the power of Australia's supermarkets, not only over their consumers, but also over the people supplying to them. Monopsony is sort of upstream monopoly power, if you like. Yes, during her later life, Joan Robinson did all kinds of surprising things. She was critiquing her own work, and she had very different views on some of those communist regimes than most economists would have. Sadie Alexander was the first African-American woman to win a PhD in economics. She did really important work looking at low-wage households in the United States, understanding how they managed to make ends meet, and looking at their inability, the challenge of being not being able to buy in bulk as being a particular tax on low-income Americans. And yet she wasn't able to get an academic position and ended up working in her husband's law firm. And the third,
Colin Clark,
of course, who ran unsuccessfully as a Labor candidate in Britain before he came out to Australia, and then came here and was crucial in the building of national account statistics. So Australia effectively became a pioneer, thanks to Colin Clark's leadership, in the building of national statistics. First job was, can we measure the output of the economy? Next job was, can we do it year to year and find out how much the thing is growing? No surprise that a lot of this work kicks off in the 1930s, where the question wasn't just how much is the economy growing, but how much is it shrinking?
As you may or may not know, Colin Clark became an economic advisor to Bob Santa Maria, and much dislike from Bob Hawke because he wouldn't supervise his thesis at Oxford. He thought it wasn't serious enough. He thought a thesis on the Australian trade union movement didn't quite fit Oxford University. And Bob never forgave him.
It does all make you wonder how that world would have been different if Colin Clark had gotten over the line and gotten elected as a Labor MP.
Or if you advised Bob Hawke on economics, perhaps.
Precisely.
Yeah. So, I mean, you cover Bretton Woods. Just briefly tell us about Bretton Woods after the end of World War II.
So after World War I, there's a move into autarky. The immigration barriers go up, the trade barriers go up, foreign investment drops. And after World War II, there's a sense among many economists that they need to get it right this time. They need to use the opportunity of the peace in order to bring countries together and build stronger connections. So Bretton Woods builds the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, providing a sense of connection between countries, but also a commitment to a set of institutions that will provide loans and grants and encourage financial stability around the world. And it works remarkably well. You see the trade barriers just steadily come down and down through those successive trade negotiating rounds, all the way through to the Uruguay round in 1993, where suddenly trade liberalisation begins to stall, and we now find ourselves in a world in which if we can stop global tariffs from rising, we feel we're doing well.
Now, I'm going to throw it open to the floor in a few minutes, but there are a couple of others, because you mentioned Joan Robinson. Now, Paul Ehrlich was a great hero, the American economist, and he came to Australia in the 60s and the 70s. Whenever he's here, he's interviewed by Philip Adams, and if he's not here, he's interviewed by Philip Adams overseas. But you compare him to Malthus, because as you point out, and as we know, I mean, he made predictions about population growth which were massively false over 20 or 30 years, and yet he remains, I mean, not in your book, but he remains a sort of respected economist.
Yeah, I'm pretty down on the Ehrlichs because of the approach that they took towards Africa and towards population growth in Africa. They advocated against ceasing food aid to developing countries, not just Africa but also India, and believed that global famine was inevitable. They didn't anticipate the way in which population growth would naturally tail off as communities developed social security schemes and people felt as though falling infant mortality meant they didn't have to have more children just in order to see an increasing number of children through to adulthood. those views on population, I think, were Malthusian, and fundamentally history has shown them to have been too pessimistic.
Now, you just mentioned India there. You make the point in your book that India never had a famine when it was a democracy, and you also make the point about the famine in the Soviet Union in the 20s, and of course the so-called Great Leap Forward in China in the late 50s, early 60s, which led to the death, estimated now, of about 45 million Chinese due to a forced famine. So what's this point about democracy?
Well, this is Amartya Sen's point, that democracy provides a sense of accountability which lets you forestall a famine. And he is very much influenced by the Bengal famine of 1943 and seeing the humanitarian catastrophe that unfolds in a country in which it's not possible for people to reach out to their leaders. Let's hope that the rule continues to hold. It is certainly one of the side benefits of democracy. And we do know that empirically democracies tend to have higher levels of living standards, higher levels of education. People in democracies tend to live longer. It is not the case that every democracy outperforms every autocracy, but on average you'd rather be living in a democracy, even if only all that you cared about was your material standards of living.
Unlike many commentators, you make the very strong point, it doesn't take up a large part of your book, you make the very strong point that about China's greenhouse emissions, and that if countries like China and other countries whose economies aren't as strong as China's, if they don't do something about global emissions, they're not going to really be reduced. So China's not reducing much, is it?
I mean, China's greenhouse emissions are decreasing. They're not accelerating. We're hoping that they're going to flatten off. But clearly, that's one of the big questions for reducing climate carbon emissions. Encouraging countries like China to follow a lower emissions path than the advanced countries followed before them. So that technology transfer is really important. China is building huge amounts of renewables infrastructure across the country. They're also building vast numbers of electric cars. The rest of us need to be encouraging that process, because the world doesn't care where a ton of carbon is produced. It has the same impact on global climate change.
But China's also building coal-fired power stations, isn't it?
It is, and so part of it is encouraging more renewables and fewer coal-fired power stations. That's a transition that they're on. Everything we can do to encourage that transition is important. China's emissions are massive, as you say.
Now, you're no longer an academic economist, which probably makes you...
But I get to play one at the Sydney Institute, right?
Yeah. And you get to write a readable book that we can understand. There's only one page I can't... There's only one paragraph I couldn't understand.
Oh.
Yeah, I'll point it out to you later.
Please.
It's got a lot of mathematics in it, you know. Now, talking about mathematics, you're sort of a model kind of guy, aren't you? You're into modelling, you know, economic modelling still? I think the answer's yes.
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of... If you look at why economics has tended to make contributions to other social sciences or colonise other social sciences, if you want to be pejorative about it, it does have to do with two big things. One is being able to come up with rigorous models, which are generalisable. The other is the facility of economists with big data. So, yes, I'm a fan of models.
Yeah, but you also say that conflicts, pandemics, famines, defaults, trade wars are often missed by economic models. So what's the point if they miss all that? How good are they?
Models aren't very good at finding turning points, which sometimes arise either because there's a non-linearity in the system. So the US builds up a whole lot of subprime mortgages. It's fine when the stock of subprime mortgages is at X, but suddenly it goes to 2X and the system blows up. It's also sometimes the case that models can't predict outside influences. So all of our models for economic growth in 2019 were working fine until suddenly an unexpected pandemic turned up in Wuhan and blew all of our predictions for the world economy out of the water.
So about to finish, as you know, I started off by quoting you saying you're a congenital optimist, which is nice. It really is.
You say that like you don't really believe it. Are you, do you think of yourself as a congenital pessimist?
Yeah, I have a general worldview that everything's bad and will invariably get worse.
But that can't be the case. Like, you believe in markets.
No, that was actually a joke. I made it. Bob Santa Maria. That was his philosophy. Anyway, but you said you were. You distracted me now. A congenital optimist. Okay, but then you come to artificial intelligence, and you say it's a catastrophic risk to humanity, and you say that climate change is bad and could get very bad indeed. That doesn't sound like an optimist to me. That sounds more like somebody thinks things are bad and will invariably get worse.
So I still think that an optimist can put on their seatbelt when they get into the car and can buy home insurance. And in the case of artificial intelligence or nuclear catastrophe, I do think we could be doing a little bit more to buy some insurance. I'm concerned around the potential of AI models to get out of control. There's no other technology I know about where 5% of those working on it think that it could spell the end of humanity. And that's the share of AI researchers who think that once the system's capacity exceeds that of humanity, that we're in for catastrophe. You want to bring that probability down from 5% to 1%. That's got a huge payoff in expected value terms. Now, and likewise, to reduce the chance of nuclear catastrophe, taking weapons off hair trigger alert. You know, I think of all of that as buying a car with airbags. You don't expect to use them, but if they're in there, you feel a little safer. And in expectation, you're living a longer life.
I'm getting vibes to conclude from the audience who want to know what this paragraph is. Page 154. System 2 is more rational but slower. When multiplying 2 by 2, we use system 1. When multiplying 17 by 24, we use system 2. And it goes on. And
so this is...
Yeah.
This is beautiful.
Please explain.
This is beautiful because it gives me a chance to talk about the late Daniel Kahneman, who was a psychologist who won the Nobel Prize in economics because of his work in establishing behavioural economics. And his most people, after they win the Nobel Prize, basically go out to pasture. Danny Kahneman wrote his very best book after winning the Nobel Prize. It's called Thinking Fast and Slow, and the idea is that we have two systems, a rapid, intuitive way of thinking and a slower, more considered way of thinking. System one, as you say, Jared, is great for working out what to do if we suddenly look over and see a truck bearing down on us. System two, though, is much better in considering whether we should buy a house. And if you use system one when you're at the auction, you may well make a very big mistake. If you use system two when you're standing in the middle of the road with a truck coming at you, you'll make a very bad mistake as well. And Kahneman's book is replete with examples in which people make system one and system two errors. And it's beautifully illustrated with all kinds of case studies, including his work with Israeli fighter pilots and his time in the Israeli Defence Forces.
So where did he live? He's American, wasn't he?
He spent much of his career as an academic in the United States, but he began at Hebrew University and of course, spent considerable time in the military, as most Israelis do.
I think it's fair to say the road toll in the United States is pretty high, so I don't know what that tells us.
You think they're using System 2 too often?
I think so, yeah. Now, we're going to go to questions and discussion now. The shortest history of economics. You should write the shortest history of long-distance running.
That would have a nice, good one, isn't it?
Yeah.
I did pitch it to my my editor, who said that he didn't think there was much of an appetite for books about the history of running.
Oh, he's wrong, I think. A lot of people do it.
Okay.
I've seen them, yeah. Anyway, we've got copies of The Shortest History of Economics here. It's a terrific book. And it goes back, it's a huge amount of work. I don't know how you quite did it with your full-time jobs, but maybe if you got full-time jobs, you're more likely to work harder doing other stuff. So that's a terrific achievement. Anyway, we've got copies outside for sale. I don't know, you'll sign them. Okay, so now we come to questions and discussion. I'm operating here, Anne and Naomi are operating down there. Anne? Everyone's got to be brief and to the point. Yeah.
Okay. I've looked through the bibliography, and very quickly, I don't see Bernard Smith mentioned there, so I'm interested in whether you think, among other things, that capitalism is the capitalism is the engine of modernity, which I think is one of his best remarks. And I'm also interested in whether you're interested at all in the Daniel Miller work on consumption.
Yeah, so, I mean, thank you, Judith. And I had to make some pretty tough choices in pulling together world history and discipline into a couple of hundred pages. So in that sense, I've focused on some of the biggest figures, but hopefully the ideas are in there. And, you know, really the transformation of the Industrial Revolution, which Jared mentioned, but we didn't delve into too much, is one of those moments of which modernity kicks off. The Agricultural Revolution increased total output, but it tended to go in increasing population size. Per-person living standards didn't change much. People actually got a little shorter. The Industrial Revolution, though, is accompanied by a massive improvement. Living standards, heights go up, life expectancy goes up, infant mortality goes down. That revolution that kicks off in a little island off the coast of mainland Europe is transformative for the world in ways we're still continuing to understand.
Economic growth as a measure inevitably leads to overconsumption. Can we break that nexus in that sense?
So what we're measuring in economic growth really isn't capturing everything that humanity values. Economic growth captures a man who makes handguns. It doesn't capture a woman who breastfeeds her baby. And that's partly reflective of the fact that it was developed by Colin Clark and others at a time when economies were much more focused on agriculture and manufacturing than the highly services-based economies we have today. So we do need to do a better job of measuring other indicators. Time use surveys are a big part of that, and Australia was a pioneer, stopped for a while, and is now back in the game of doing time use surveys because they capture a lot of the unpaid work in an economy, which some of the feminist economists, such as Marilyn Waring, have argued may well be as valuable as all of the market output put together.
Thank you. Since 1974, when Richard Nixon took the American dollar off the gold standard, governments throughout the Western world have printed trillions of dollars, euros, pounds, other currencies, including our own government. Does economic history demonstrate that will inevitably end in tears?
Well, Mark, the gold standard was getting pretty fragile by the end. In some sense, the idea that the price level should increase at the rate of discovery of gold was always a little problematic, and the ability of governments to be able to repay claims in gold was getting fragile as economies grew faster than the gold reserves of those countries. In general, I think having floating exchange rates has been pretty useful as a shock absorber, particularly for a medium-sized country like Australia, where we would have fared much worse through the global financial crisis, through the Asian financial crisis, through the US tech wreck, if we hadn't had that shock absorber effect of a floating exchange rate.
You talked about feudalism and the Black Death. Feudalism persisted in the Russian Empire until the 19th century. Was the experience of the Black Death different then? And could you also talk about Piketty's diagnosis that inequality in Western countries is now at pre-revolutionary levels?
Wow. Can't imagine two bigger questions than those, Jonathan. It is true that the Black Death didn't take as big a toll in the East. It was much more prevalent in the West. I haven't seen scholars who've looked at whether that explains why feudalism endured longer, but certainly it makes sense on its face. In terms of Piketty's diagnosis, I mean, I talk about the so-called elephant curve of world growth, which has seen quite solid growth among the 20th to 40th percentiles of the world income distribution, the middle class in poor countries, less rapid growth from the kind of 60th to 80th percentiles, the middle class in advanced countries, and then huge growth at the very top, the elites, the millionaires, the billionaires. So that's seen inequality rise substantially. Piketty's argument would be that need not be inevitable, that it's possible to have rapid economic growth without inequity, and indeed that's the story of many advanced economies in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, a period the French call les trente glorieuses, the glorious 30 years.
Thank you. Thanks for that talk, that was wonderful. You've talked a lot about resources having a huge impact, overwhelming resources having an impact on wars and so forth. What weight do you place in economic history for first mover advantage? You know, I think Watt and the steam engine. I think, you know, actually the Nazi Germany and Blitzkrieg, you know, taking advantage of them being able to decide when they move. What weight do you place on being first?
It certainly matters a lot, Mike, particularly, well, in the case of innovation, it matters once you've got patent protection and you're able to take advantage of your innovation for the first 20 years. You know, one of the things that you don't get prior to the patent system, people are trying to use secrets in order to exploit the advantage of their invention. After the patent system, you have a lovely deal, share it with the world, and you get a monopoly for 20 years. And you see sometimes the first and second movers very close together, the classic being patents for the telephone, which are all filed almost simultaneously. I haven't thought about the implication on the battlefield, but it makes sense that others were learning from battlefield tactics, just as the Nazis' initial advantage on the battlefield was steadily eroded by the Allies. So too, I think we've seen in the Ukraine conflict, some of those tactics that were used quite effectively by the Ukrainians in the first year now seem to be being matched by the Russians, the use of drones and the like. So I think it illustrates nicely your point that there is a first mover advantage, but it erodes.
Leon.
No patents on military technologies.
I'm interested in how the United States developed. It seemed to me it started basically with the American Civil War, then the First World War, and then after Pearl Harbor, Roosevelt got the leaders of industry to then basically organize the industrial side. Is that how it really turned out? And how does America at that stage from 1943 on compare to the United States today economically?
Well, Leon, at this stage, for much of the 20th century, you see the United States leading other countries in terms of its institutions for commerce and also its deep funding base. Part of the advantage of scale is that you're able to sell to a market, you know, now 300 and something million people without having to worry about moving goods across borders. And in many other countries, scale is a limitation on the ability of firms to grow. There's certainly a role that Roosevelt plays in getting some of those big projects off the ground, but I would see his role more in terms of building infrastructure than in terms of directly investing in the economy. Quite a contrast to, say, the way in which the French or even the British economies are operating over that period, where large swaths, not just of the transport network, but of industry itself are owned and run by the government. The US has always placed a greater emphasis on private commerce, and that's its strength for growth, but also a challenge for equity.
Great speech.
Thank you.
Thanks for making economics interesting for a non-an economist. In a very brief way, could you explain to me when the study of money, or whatever we call it, went from accounting to a science? So how did it develop into something we regard as a science, economics?
Yeah, so money has three purposes: a store of value, a unit of account, and a medium of exchange. And early on, there is a notion that money needs to be valuable in itself. Gold and silver make up coins because they can be melted down and have an inherent value. And then there's a move towards first minting coins out of less precious metals, and also the Chinese initiating the move towards paper money, which is really inherently worthless and only has value by dint of all of us agreeing that that paper money has value. And that obviously has a huge simplifying effect on commerce. So in the case of money, the scholarship is lagging probably by hundreds of years, the practicality. The changes in money really are merchants and governments recognising what will be good for the economy, and then it's only economic historians later on who come along and say, "Wow, look at what a good impact this has." Of course, you know, the initial innovation of money means that I don't have to get you to take my cow in exchange for your bushel of wheat. But then the move towards paper money means that we can do the cow bushel of wheat exchange far more simply with a lightweight currency.
It wasn't so long ago that people thought money was cash, and now cash is sort of going, I hear. Does that disturb you as an economist?
I mean, I think cash is going to be around for a long time, partly because there's a simplicity for certain transactions, whether that's buying things at a street stall or tipping somebody. There's also a share of the population who are less comfortable with digital money. But it is so dramatic when you look at those graphs from the Reserve Bank, the decline of cash. I'm trying to think the last time I handled a banknote. I'm sure it's not this month, but possibly it wasn't last month either. So there's a big transition underway, and therefore the price of the payment system really matters. And there's much more scrutiny now and saying, well, if you're simply transferring electronic money, why are you charging 2% rather than 0.2%? And that's a healthy thing.
But you're very concerned about, and rightly so, about equality. Seems to me that there's certain benefits to people on lower income of a cash economy. For example, people getting tipped, low-income people getting tipped in restaurants, taxi drivers and the like. That seems to be fading out now because you can't really tip. It's hard to tip with a credit card.
That's right, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking the only note I have sitting in my wallet is a $50 note, so it would have to be a really good service to tip the only cash I have on hand. So those frictions are going to be a challenge as we move through to a cashless economy. But the final phasing out of cash, well, I can't imagine that. I'm responsible for the Mint as the Assistant Minister for Treasury, so I'm probably also responsible for telling you that there are some fantastic collectible coins out there if you'd like to continue to keep in the cash business. AFL coins, sporting events, historical events, they've got the lot. A Tooth Fairy coin, they even make one of those.
We release vast amounts of information into the world through our use of cell phones and through our cashless society where transactions are now all recorded. Is this not going to have a very profound effect on future economic modelling? That vast amount of data that's going to be available for calibrating?
Absolutely. One of the things that the Australian Bureau of Statistics used to do is that when it wanted to understand what was happening to grocery prices, it would send people out to look at the stickers on the shelf. Now, every week, the Australian Bureau of Statistics gets a download of every single item scanned in all of the major supermarkets. If it helps you think about the volume of that data, 10 million households in Australia, most shopping more than once a week, walking into supermarkets with, on average, about 15,000 items on the shelves. All of that data is being aggregated, and that's what the Australian Bureau of Statistics is using as it's producing consumer that portion of the inflation numbers. So we have far better data than we ever did before, but that's got significant privacy implications sitting around it. While I think it's terrific the ABS has access to those big data, I'm more concerned about a recent study that Reset Australia did, where they set up fake teen profiles on popular social media platforms and got those teens to look at a few pieces of eating disorder content and then asked the question, what does the algorithm then feed to them? And many of the algorithms then began promoting harmful eating disorder content at these fake teen profiles using the big data that was in their systems and extrapolating from what those profiles had seen. So there's definitely two sides to the big data challenge, and as a parent and a policymaker, I'm thinking about both of them.
So just a question about competition and religion. How well does that theory hold up or explain things in Australia where I suppose we've got as diverse a religious scene now as perhaps the United States, but it's not quite clear that our levels of religiosity are too much better than Scandinavia.
Yes, I mean, I think it explains it in part, but it wouldn't. It's not the only thing that's going on with religiosity. And a rise in secular values seems to characterise most of the world. One of the interesting things that I've seen in the data too is that church attendance is falling faster, or attendance at all religious events is falling faster than belief. So there's a rise in so-called nominalism, people who are adherents who don't turn up on Sunday. And that's of a piece with the broader decline in community, the drop in participation in Scouts and Guides and Rotary and Lions. When I speak to church leaders, they're as worried about believers who don't show up as they are about the rise in non-belief.
Hi, Andrew. I haven't had the opportunity, obviously, to read your book yet. I'm looking forward to it. My study of economics is limited just to an undergraduate degree in the late 70s, but when I did that degree, I seem to recall that we spent a lot of time talking about a bloke called Milton Friedman, and there ain't no such thing as a free lunch and stuff like that. Is that covered and is that relevant these days, or is that no longer relevant?
No, absolutely. I mean, Milton Friedman is important. He really could have won two Nobel Prizes, one for his work in micro, one for his work in macro. He is somebody who was always willing to think in a counterintuitive way and wasn't much troubled by where his views took him. The pay-as-you-go income tax system in the United States is largely credited to Friedman. The system of income contingent loans that became HECS help in Australia was written down by Friedman. Negative income taxes were a Friedman idea. There's just so much in there. And then the contributions on the macro side, with which, you know, I as a new Keynesian would disagree, but gee, he sharpened up the thinking of the new Keynesians by saying, well, why wouldn't you just imagine that people are rational? What's wrong with saying that when the government announces it's going to go on a spending spree in order to get the economy back on track, why wouldn't a rational household think, well, that's going to be funded out of my taxes in the future, so I'm going to begin saving for those future taxes? It turns out that's not a perfect description of how the world works, but the Keynesian models that emerged to respond to Friedman are way better than the ones that preceded him. So he was an extraordinary economist, and you know, as with all so many of these people, I feel like I would have loved to have more of him in the book, but that I had a page limit. Optimising subject to constraints is, after all, what economics does.
As you know, you do two pages on Friedman, which is pretty good for a book of 200 pages, but you do make the point here. In the Reagan administration, the individual tax rate reduced from 70% to 28%. That's a huge change.
It's a massive shift, yes. And of course, with that came deficits. Reagan presides over huge deficits as a result of wanting both to increase defence spending and to decrease taxes.
Second last question. So you talked about how the ABS is using that big data of a cashless society. What about the ATO? What are they doing?
So what folks at the ATO will say to me is, if you're worried that someone might be avoiding, someone with whom you're transacting might be avoiding tax, just make sure you do a bank transfer and leave the rest to us.
Final question. Great book. What do you want to next?
Trying to do my day job. So we announced some changes today, which will see a different merger regime if they go through Parliament. And inspired by a lot of the thinking of economists about the importance of competition. Economists recognise that while an individual business may want to be the only one in the field, it is very healthy for an economy to have a range of different businesses. And one of the problems that's arisen in Australia is a lack of proper scrutiny of mergers. Right now, 3 out of 4 mergers aren't seen by the competition watchdog. And you can't block what you can't see. So we're excited by the changes we announced here in Sydney this morning. Jim Chalmers gave the Bannerman Lecture at the Museum of Contemporary Art, a short walk from here. And that's, in our view, is going to help create a more dynamic economy. So having the, it was Samuelson who said, I don't care who writes the nation's laws so long as I can write its textbooks. The ability to dabble in both book writing and law writing feels like both a pleasure and a privilege.